You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It began with unbearable pain, an alarming development for a woman 7 months pregnant. And before too long, Dr. Rena Audish was losing her grip on life.
All at once, I felt a sudden release and lightness. I could see the operating room clearly, although I struggled to orient myself. The view was deceptive, in the way pilots staring for too long at the horizon can sometimes suffer sensory illusions that cause them to mistake the sea for the sky. My orientation was inverted. I was falling up. I could see the frustrated anesthesiologist who was working on placing IV access as I crashed. I could see the monitoring equipment surrounding me, the obstetrical team readying with instruments to extract the baby. I could see myself on the table. It struck me that they were right. They were losing me. If I could see myself, perhaps I was already lost. I felt nothing. The pain miraculously gone. The panic surrounding the pain was gone. An anodyne peace. I felt weightless, buoyant, and very small. I watched the events unfold before me, unattached to any outcome, with an easy stillness. I had died.
Dr. Audish did not die, but she had to endure a very long, very tough recovery from the medical crisis that cost her the life of her unborn child. And as a physician who cared for patients in the intensive care unit, she learned profound lessons about how doctors and nurses practice medicine. Dr. Audish is with the Department of Pulmonary and Critical Care Medicine at Henry Ford Health System. Her new memoir is called In Shock, My Journey from Death to Recovery and the Redemptive Power of Hope. Dr. Rena Audish, pleasure to welcome you to Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me.
So there you were, having what appeared to be a good, uneventful pregnancy, and then you're literally brought to your knees with pain?
That's right. I was 7 months pregnant when the pain came on out of nowhere.
And you wound up on an operating table and then in the ICU where you had been working at the very hospital at the where you worked as a physician. What happened to you?
We didn't know at the time, but I had a tumor in my liver that grows with pregnancy. And pregnancy is a very dangerous time for that reason. They're called hepatic adenomas. And it basically burst open while I was at dinner. And in the space of really 2 hours, I lost my entire blood volume into my abdomen, which led to most of my organs shutting down. I had kidney failure. My liver failed. I was unable to breathe unassisted. I was placed on life support, and I had a stroke from the lack of blood flow. So I really went from a critical care physician one moment to a critically ill patient. I had specifically targeted my own hospital. I felt that if anyone could help me, it would be us. I really believed in the care that we provided. And so that was a very purposeful decision to drive to Henry Ford.
So it's fair to say you were slammed with about as severe a medical crisis as could be. How long before it took you to get back to good health? And we should note, as we mentioned, sadly, you did lose your unborn baby. So you had that to deal with as well as the physical recovery.
Yes. And to be honest, as a physician, I knew how fortunate I was to recover from that catastrophic hemorrhage. And while certainly the loss of the baby was a sad moment for our family, it was not in any way unexpected. I was amazed that I had survived that and felt very grateful for the care that I had received. All in all, it actually took 8 years to recover, 5 surgeries and many ICU admissions and procedures. And I'm happy to say it'll be 2 years in February since I've been a patient in the hospital.
What most surprised you as a patient about the things that were done and said by your doctors and nurses as you went through this ordeal?
What surprised me the most was really how poorly trained we are to give bad news well. I knew the people caring for me. They are tremendously skilled, and I really respect the work that they do and that we all do. But what I realized was hard was telling me things about my kidneys failing or when the baby had died those things were actually hard for my providers to do well. And I recognized, you know, I similarly had trouble giving bad news well and really focusing on the emotional needs of my patients. They did an unbelievable job with the clinical care, and I believe I survived something that was truly unsurvivable. But I was left with this feeling of gosh, we don't always say things in a way that promotes healing. We can actually be adversaries to our patients in many ways.
Well, and you write in your book, and I'll quote you here, "Medicine is a culture that does not indulge suffering, though it is everywhere. It is the most important thing to attend to, and we are constantly dismissing it, pushing it aside, whether it's our own suffering or the patient's suffering or our family's suffering. We push it aside to get to the patient." Why do you think that is?
You know, I think that's a product of our training. Medical training really is so focused on the disease itself. It's something we're enamored by. We chase it. And you'll still hear physicians say this is a really good case when it's something catastrophic for the person who's suffering with it. And our orientation is really to the disease itself. We are looking for it in patients without always an understanding of how it impacts them, how their course of their life is changed by these diagnoses.
And it takes a toll on, it's clear from your book, it takes a toll not just on the patients who have to have things said that are insensitive or somebody's kind of slouching against the door wall and kind of delivers some bad news and slouches out again, but it takes a toll on the caregivers.
You know, I'm so glad that you point that out, because that was truly the biggest revelation to me in writing the book. And when I sat with all of the events that happened and really looked at them in retrospect, I realized how much suffering was happening for providers, that, you know, myself included, when I lost patients that I wanted more than anything to help, there was no place to go with that. I didn't feel I could talk about it in a way that would promote my own healing. It's just not our culture. We move on to the next patient, whether it's in the next ICU bed or in the next clinical encounter. It's just what we do.
Well, and it strikes me that the things that make a physician a good physician, battling disease, treating it as you know, as an enemy to be destroyed, that takes a toll.
Absolutely. I think that whole paradigm that we've set up where it is a war on cancer, it is a battle to be fought, that even that language can be harmful, not just for the patients who then feel that if they're not quote unquote fighting, that they're giving up, but also for the physician, because if they're in a war against something, that's the only paradigm then is to win or lose. And I think we have to reframe the language. We have to begin to think about it in terms of truly partnering and walking alongside our patients in the same direction through the illness rather than fighting against something.
I'm speaking with Dr. Rena Audish. Her memoir is In Shock, My Journey from Death to Recovery and the Redemptive Power of Hope. She is a critical care medicine specialist who wound up on the other side of the equation as a patient in and out of intensive care units for years, the intensive care unit at the hospital where she worked at Henry Ford Hospital. And you now run a program at Henry Ford called CLEAR Conversations. What does CLEAR stand for?
CLEAR stands for Connect, Listen, Empathize, Align, and Respect. And it really is the value system that we seek to embody in all of our training. So we believe that true healing happens in the context of a relationship, and that we must cultivate that connection with our patients, that we have to listen generously. We have to know what matters to our patients. We have to empathize when emotion enters the conversation, which I think traditionally physicians aren't as well trained to do. We stay in the cognitive channel much more than we do the emotional channel. We try to align with patient goals, which of course means knowing what matters to our patients, knowing what their values are, and then respect those values. So never put forth a treatment plan that isn't in alignment with what the patient would want for their life. There's so much that medicine can offer these days. But if it isn't in the context of what our patients want, it's relatively meaningless. We're doing it for ourselves then.
I'm wondering, do you see room for humor from physicians and nurses, the kind that helps them blow off the stress? You know what I'm talking about, that kind of dark humor.
You know, that was the only coping mechanism that I think was modeled to me in all of my training. And to me, it's sad that that was all that we had. We had that ability to joke about something and this sort of graveyard humor that sometimes happens in healthcare. But I really think it's a sign of a deeper level of distress that people don't necessarily know what to do with. And that's what's socially sanctioned within medicine, is that joking. And I'd like to see where we can get past that and talk really honestly about our feelings in a more constructive way.
Well, your book truly is a call to action to the medical profession and also has so many deep insights for patients and for family members. So really, it's everybody. And Dr. Oddish will be at Literati in Ann Arbor tomorrow night, Thursday the 30th at 7 p.m. And she'll be talking about this powerful memoir, In Shock, My Journey from Death to Recovery and the Redemptive Power of Hope. It is quite a powerful book, and it is good to know that you and your family did have the happy ending of eventually having your little boy, Walt. And by the way, your husband, Randy, Saint Randy.
Oh, he'll appreciate that. Thank you.
Doctor, thank you so much for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs.